Continuing with Air Marshal Dunlap, the date is May 20th, 1980, and this is side number two.
Not the last time. You want to check this for reception?
All right.
We were discussing the Joint Air Training Plan and some of the problems attending the finalization of the plan and the formal signing of the agreement in Ottawa. I had mentioned that the plan had been accepted in principle way back in mid-October, but there were many rather sticky details and to be worked out, and Canada was being amongst the stickiest members around the table. And although there were a variety of points at issue, initially a lot of those had to do with economic and financial aspects, even trade aspects. But the stickiest one of all had to do with what was to happen in the case of the Canadian air crew, the RCF air crew, when they got to England. Now, Mr. King took a very strong and firm stand on this, and I think he was supported by most, if not all, of his cabinet. Certainly the members from the province of Quebec. Excuse me. Pull that back. The point of the issue, of course, was the matter of the question of independence for the Canadian forces in the combat theater. It was very clear in the minds of Canadian leaders, military particularly, and political also, that during World War I, the Canadian Canada didn't really, in effect, operate independently in the combat zone. This applied particularly to the Canadian airmen, because there wasn't, as we mentioned in previous interviews, there wasn't any Canadian squadron, Canadian wing, or any other Canadian aviation formation serving in the overseas theater during the combat phase. Notwithstanding the fact that there were thousands of Canadian pilots, thousands of Canadian aircrew serving overseas with the British force. Now this was, the numbers were so great, and the contribution by Canada was so great, that it was the sort of thing that one didn't want to stumble into again or allow to happen again, because if there is no independent force, there is no real recognition of the contribution made by one's citizens in combat. And of course there are a variety of other reasons for wanting to be independent. One wants to be independent also to demonstrate one's autonomy and one's sovereignty as a nation. And that back in those days, certainly from World War I onwards, became an issue in Canada. We had been more or less a dependent nation, a dominion, or even in the eyes of some of our British friends, a colonial power, and there wasn't any intention of letting that happen again. Mr. King had actually demonstrated his feelings of this quite forcibly during the period through 1938, when the UK authorities were endeavoring to set up a training facility in Canada. They wanted the RAF to operate a training school here. They wanted to train in that school both Canadian and British, young Canadian British aspirants to an Air Force career. Now that was during the time that the crisis was building up in Europe, and the Western world, Canada included, were very conscious of the dangers that were being created by Hitler and Germany. And one might have expected a real measure of cooperation by Canada at that time with Britain. It was a surprise, really. I think it was a surprise to a lot of Canadians, too, that Mr. King proved so difficult. But he didn't want, and he didn't feel he should, become committed in any way to the United Kingdom in even the preparations for a build-up prior to war. He was afraid that that might be construed by some of the body of Canadians as getting entangled before Canada had had an opportunity herself to make a decision as to whether she wanted to go to war. And of course, this was a very a very important consideration having regard to the troubles over conscription in World War I. And there had been certain commitments made, particularly in the direction of Quebec, that Canada would not become, would not be dragged into a war. Canada would make a conscious decision, and the Canadian Parliament would make a conscious decision as to whether or not Canada would enter the war. And these were commitments that had been long-standing and oft reiterated, and as a lot of the support of the Liberal Party, which Mr. King headed, came from the province of Quebec, he had to walk a fairly careful, narrow course. And I think that that in itself had a great deal to do with his strange, I guess you would call it, response to the British approach. He seemed quite willing for Canadians to go over and train with the RAF. And indeed, there was an undertaking to, if I remember correctly, to assist in even the recruiting of Canadians to go over there to join the RAF. But that was a different matter. That was Canadians on their own volition going over and joining another service, and that therefore did not entangle Canada in any way. It was an individual matter. But when it came to setting up a school, and the British proposed that these same Canadians, there were a group of 120 of them in that year, 1938, who were going to go over to be trained in the RAF schools. When the British proposed that they be trained in Canada, he wouldn't agree to that. That was a different matter. He wouldn't agree to that at all. The British put up several alternative proposals to try to get his agreement. One of them being that in this school to be set up in 1938, these 120 Canadians would be trained. Such other Canadians as wished to volunteer in there would be added to that number. And the balance of the capacity of the school, which I think was to have been about output of about 300 a year, would come from Britain. I think the British authorities thought that that arrangement might appeal to Canada. They'd be training mostly Canadians. He was even more difficult on that proposal than he had been on earlier proposals. He seemed to argue with the British that, that they were endeavoring to use Canada as a recruiting ground, and this was a dodge to use Canada as a major recruiting ground, and he wasn't in favor of that. So all of these things, I guess these were all part of the overall picture in which he was afraid of doing anything that might give the impression in certain parts of the country that we were being carried along, tagging behind the the apron strings into England. The mother country dictated and wished. And I think that had a lot to do with it.
He wasn't about to have RAF bases here, presumably commanded by an RAF.
That's right. That's right, yeah. That was, I should have stressed that point. That was an irritant. That was a thing that it could be pointed at. And take an issue with. Well, at any rate, he maintained this stand for quite a long period of time, and there were approaches made to him at a whole series of levels. There was a mission sent out in, I guess it was in 37 or 38, late 37 or 38, to, in connection with the establishment of aircraft manufacturing facilities in Canada. And the head of that mission was charged with, while he was here, several proposals had been made and fallen flat before that. And he was a distinguished industrialist, and he was charged with seeing Mr. King and trying to move him on this. And, he didn't make any headway. In fact, I think he irritated Mr. King more than somewhat, so that didn't come off. So, all in all, it was a very difficult period, but as was almost bound to happen, the opposition parties got wind of this and decided it was a fair issue that would appeal to Canada at large, if not to Quebec, Canada, and that in the forthcoming election it would be something worth taking a stand on. And Mr. King got wind of the fact that the opposition were going to use this as an issue, and they were having a leadership convention or something like that about that. He got wind of the fact that this was going to be a major plank in their platform when they went to the country. So, being the politician that he was, he decided he'd spike their gun, so he called in the British High Commissioner and said that he had given the matter further consideration, that he would like to High Commissioner to notify the UK authorities that he was ready to proceed without delay, and he felt that announcement should be made since the matter was so important within days, and would he set it up with the UK authorities that almost immediately, announcement was made that Canada had agreed to enter into this arrangement to, in the face of the growing deterioration of the world situation, Europe, and so on, and so on. So, a few days before the convention was about to take place, this announcement was made, and of course, as things happened, it was overtaken by events, and never did come about, because the war broke out before the school
right.
Back
what was
up.
The what was the feeling of the RCAF or the officers of the RCAF with this apparent delay in getting on with the job? Were you rather upset about it? What was the
well? I was in the UK at the time, so I can't really speak too much on that issue. But I think that the average. My contemporaries, of course, we were not in the decision, senior decision-making level. We just couldn't understand this type of reaction.
Mm-hmm.
It was a fairly obscure bit of reasoning that Mr. King was holding pretty close to his chest. And although it was his thinking was exposed to the cabinet, I don't think the cabinet were even permitted to talk about it. They didn't want it to become even known that Canada was being approached. Mr. King felt it'd be better to keep this all quiet. So I remember hearing a little bit about it briefly. Maybe it was because I was in the UK. I think it was pretty tightly held, and even in the service, there were not too many people who who knew about it. They would be at Air Force headquarters, of course. But once again, they probably were sworn to treating it on a very confidential basis by direction from the head man.
Yes, well, I think this his point of view is certainly... All
this I've introduced here is a bit of background for what I want to say about the final deliberations, the dragging on of the finalization of the training plan. It dragged on, as I said, it was approved in principle in October. It dragged on through November and December, and it still hadn't been settled by mid-December. And the point at issue was this so-called Article 15 of the treaty. And, I guess treaty's not the word, the training plan. And this article touched on, but not in very precise terms, the formation of squadrons overseas from Canada and the other dominions. It was, to Mr. King, it was very vague, and to the Minister of Defense also, and I presume to a number of other cabinet ministers. And there was an exchange of correspondence as well as an exchange at the conference table, trying to get the British to be specific on just what this meant. And Canada was endeavoring to make it absolutely clear that the formation of Canadian squadrons overseas was of great importance to us. And not only that, the operation of those of the squadrons, when there were a sufficient number of them, under the direction of Canadian operational headquarters, was an important consideration too. What the British wanted was to leave this a little bit open and be subject to government-to-government discussions as time went on. After all, the war had just broken out and Britain was in a very exposed position, and anything could happen. They didn't know just what was going to happen. They were expected to be bombed momentarily, and they were surprised that they hadn't been under a heavy assault before this, and they wanted to get on with the details of forming the plan and leave some of these other matters, which were further down the road, and they were a fair distance down the road, because we had to establish the schools first, get the aircraft, get training the skilled personnel to train the air crew, and that was... And the training courses for a pilot were about a year in length. So it meant that the output was not going to come until on towards the end of 1940. And even then, it would be a small trickle compared to what was coming on later. And to the British, it wasn't quite as immediate a matter and could be left. But, and the British were a little... became a little bit sticky, and they they came back after some come and go on both sides with a statement that they felt that the number of squadrons, Canadian squadrons formed overseas, should be related to the amount of money Canada was putting into the plan. And since we had driven such a hard bargain on cost sharing in the plan, and they came back and said that there was some justification for placing a figure on the number of squadrons in relation to the Canadian financial contribution. Being as hard pressed as they were in all directions at the time, it wasn't a surprising position for the British to take. And furthermore, I don't think that on the Canadian side, many of those who were standing fast had stopped to consider all of the factors. It wasn't a simple matter to just say, well, we'll form. We'll take these Canadian aircrew and put them into to Canadian squadrons. Because actually, what they were talking about were Canadian aircrew. And the aircrew is a small portion of the squadron. It's an important portion of the squadron. But if you're talking of a fighter squadron, for example, where there's only one pilot on an aircraft, single-seater fighter squadron, you only got about 20 to 25 aircrew in that squadron, whereas there are several hundred personnel to make that squadron function. There were certainly not going to be any Canadian ground crew available for a long period of time, because we were hard-pressed, and we're going to be hard-pressed for a couple of years getting the ground crew trained and filling in the establishments of all these training schools in the DCATP. So it was obvious to the British that we weren't in a position to become fully Canadianized. And therefore, your squadron was going to be, in many cases, 80 or 90% UK personnel. Personnel, and about 10% Canadian, or with a bomber squadron, the percentages would be different. It might be 20 or 25% Canadian personnel and 75% British. They couldn't quite see what all the fuss was about and the urgency, really. I think they were Harold Balfour, who was one of the key figures on the British team. I think he had a pretty good grasp of the Canadian position, but he couldn't get excited about the urgency of it, and he felt that they could sit around the table and settle all these things later. But and then there were also further considerations of this nature. For example, if you had if Canada wanted to have Canadian squadrons assembled onto one base, which would be a natural second stage. It's one thing to get the Canadian squadrons formed, but it would be better still to have a wing composed of three Canadian squadrons, or if it's a flying station or a base composed of three or four Canadian squadrons, as the case may be. But then again, without a lot of Canadian administrative personnel and staff available overseas, those wings and headquarters and wing staffs and base headquarters and base staffs would all be British. And that was could be a source of irritation to Canada and to the British and so on. So their proposal was that the squadron should be Canadian, RAF Canadian squadrons. That was the designation, I think. They would be RAF squadrons in which the aircrew were primarily Canadian, not necessarily entirely Canadian, but primarily. And perhaps they also, and this would be a natural reaction, they felt that Canada hadn't had any operational experience in war, and maybe those RAF Canadian squadrons would be commanded initially by RAF people, who to them had a great deal more experience in great deal more experience in warfare. Well, this was only the second, third month of the war, and you might say, well, the RAF didn't have an awful lot of war experience by that time, but a lot of those fellows in the RAF had served for years out in the Northwest Frontier, and although the type of warfare was very different, they were accustomed to operations under battle conditions, different though they were, and they had operated under fire, and then they must that fire was rifle fire from the mountainsides, but it was fairly effective at times, and they were slightly blooded, let's say. And, they tended, therefore, to think of the Canadians as being very uninitiated when it came to leadership in war. And I'm quite sure that they were a little reluctant at this stage to commit themselves too deeply until we got a little bit more experience. So there were these factors on the British side and on the On the Canadian, of course, it was a matter of autonomy and sovereignty and independence. We wanted to demonstrate our independence. Not only the British in the main, except perhaps in a few of the highest places in the Foreign Office and in other government circles. We're very conscious of the fact that Canada had become independent, an independent nation. Certainly we hadn't demonstrated our independence to any great degree up to that time. And we were in a position, it was time for us to do so. I think that was very much behind the stand that Canada was taking. And this was the time to dig our feet in. Well, I quibbled over this clause back and forth right up to, as I say, mid-December, and Mr. King was anxious to get it settled, and the Canadian government was anxious to get it settled, because of the timing of the arrival of the 1st Canadian Division overseas. They wanted the announcement to come. I can't remember if they wanted it just before the arrival of the division or just after. They didn't want it to come at the same time anyway. And here they were. These two events were focusing right in together. And finally, the thing was rushed a little bit at the end, and there was a compromise position, which was, I guess, reasonably satisfactory to Canada. I think they took, between the 15th of December and the 17th of December, somebody told me that they changed one word in the agreement, and that they took a Z out or something like that. instead of saying, the Canadian air crew will be formed into Canadian squadrons at such time as the Canadian government so requests. I think they took the Z out and said Canadian air crew would be, or something like that. It didn't make it quite as precise. It gave the impression that there would be some Canadian air crew who would and some who wouldn't flow into purely Canadian squadrons. And already it was becoming more evident to the Canadian authorities that the number of Canadian air crew involved was such that there would be a huge number of Canadian squadrons. And although the cost factor was, and the cost arrangement was such that this wasn't a matter of overriding concern to Canada at that time, because after all, the British are going to pay most of the shot financing these Canadian squadrons overseas anyway, as the way Canada had been driving the bargain. But I think there were certain people who felt that before long the burden of cost would swing over to Canadian shoulders, or that Canada would want to finance their own effort quite independently of the British. And if we had too many squadrons, if we allowed all of these Canadians to go into Canadian squadrons, or if we demanded that they all go into Canadian squadrons, let's put it that way, we would be biting off more than we could chew.
Was there ever any thought of restricting the number of Canadians joining the air crew at that time?
No, it was agreed under the training plan that was part of the plan. Down what the output would be, and well, yes, there were some ceilings put on it, but the numbers were vast.
Well,
there were,
yeah.
For example, every 4 weeks, the output of from elementary high and training schools in Canada was to be over 500 graduates, and from the advanced training schools. They were called service line training schools, the advanced schools, which brought these fellows right up to the point of going overseas. The output was over 500 a month, 500 every 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing with the navigators, sort of equivalent numbers, and air gunners and bomb aimers, equivalent numbers. So that was the initial output. After that, it got, as we went down further down the road, when the second plan was written, and then it got considerably greater than that. So you can see that, and all those numbers, to give you some feel for it, About 50% of them were going to be Canadians. So it showed you the number of Canadians flowing overseas under this plan every 4 weeks, even under that first stage of the plan before it was accelerated.
Of course, you could produce air crew at a much quicker rate than you could produce the trained technical staff, presumably, to ground crew. As
well, no, I don't think that applied. I think you could. You're referring to experience, really experienced ones, yeah. But you could train fitters and riggers for most of the functions at a more rapid rate than that. But if you're thinking in terms of junior NCOs and senior NCOs, yes, it took quite a long time to get the experience there. But there were some pretty damn good fitters and riggers that were turned out in a matter of 4, 5, 6 months. As the war went on, the time got shorter. Notwithstanding that fact, that output had to flow into the training to support the operation of the training schools here in Canada. And that would apply throughout the whole of the build-up of the training plan. The build-up of the training plan was going to run its way in towards the end of 1941, or sometime in that period. So that was I think it might be interesting just to make a reference to the cost arrangements, because again, we were really operating almost a peacetime show when we were negotiating with the British on this. Well, there was no, we hadn't become crisis conscious insofar as the financial side was concerned. We were operating on balance the budget, boys, and don't do anything to overstrain the economy basis. And therefore, these Canadians who were going to serve overseas, even in the Canadianized squadrons, were going to be paid for by the Royal Air Force. They were going to be paid for by the British authorities. They were going to provide the bases. They were going to provide the aircraft. They were going to pay the personnel, the Canadian personnel. And all we were going to do was supplement the pay to bring it up to Canadian levels of pay. And that, of course, was an irritant to the British, because it meant that Canadians serving side by side with their British cousins were going to get more pay. And although there wasn't anything they could do about that, it was a sort of thing that could give rise to unpleasantness in a unit. So one person doing the same job getting more pay than the other. We were sort of being a little bit colonial there. We were setting out to fight this war in 1939 on a basis you would have expected Canada to operate on when back in the Boer War days. So we were, on the one hand, being fairly colonial in our approach to things. On the other hand, trying to be very independent. And you can't be terribly independent if you're not prepared to pay your own way. And I think that was perhaps one of the reasons that the two sides were having such difficulty. However sympathetic the British might have been to our Canadian point of view, they weren't prepared to get too excited as long as they were paying most of the shot. Now, we felt, on the Canadian side, to be fair, that we were paying a pretty big entrance fee into this operation by the amount of money we were putting into the training plan. It was big. It was a large sum on any basis of Canadian thinking at that time. I think that we were leaning a little bit too heavily on that, because nobody was stopping to considered just how much it was going to cost Britain to operate. The argument was, well, Britain would have to do it anyway. If we didn't provide the aircrew, they'd have to provide them themselves, and it would cost them. They'd have to provide their own base. They'd have to supply the aircraft. They'd have to provide their own aircrew and so on. Why shouldn't they pay? I suppose it was natural for Canada to take the stand they did. It was we hadn't progressed far enough along in conditioning our thoughts to war and a war economy at that time, and it wasn't surprising that we operated on that basis. It took many months. It took the deterioration of the situation in Europe, the assault on Norway and the advance through the Low Country and the fall of France and everything else to really jolt us out of that attitude. Once we did, Canada made a tremendous effort in all directions, including the financial contribution. There it was. There was the problem. Now, eventually it was resolved, and I don't know whether it was actually written into this Article 50, I can't remember, but there was an understanding that as soon as possible Canada would form some squadrons overseas, and there was a ceiling at that time, I think, put on of about 15, to be further negotiated. Well, ultimately, and I don't know how long this took, but ultimately that figure was increased to 25 Canadian squadrons overseas. And then, of course, as the war progressed, the number got much more than that. But it settled down at that figure for planning purposes. Now, when we were discussing this matter of ground crew, and you were asking about the length of time to train them and so on, I had intended to make a further point when I told you that the flow of those personnel would be required in the training plan to meet the demands there for a long period of time. But I forgot to mention also that there was a pretty sizable expansion taking place in the home war establishment squadrons here in the Atlantic and the Pacific Coast. And we had, as the submarine threat became very evident, and the Germans had operating submarines far afield, we had very important assignments in relation to convoy escort, particularly on the East Coast. And that meant more and more coastal squadrons, coastal reconnaissance squadrons, and maritime squadrons, as they're now called. And that build-up called for the constant flow of some proportions of both ground crew and air crew. So there was a flow of air crew and ground crew required to meet these demands. And not only was there a big build-up on the Atlantic coast, but there was a big build-up on the Pacific coast, which got greater after Japan came into the show. But even before Japan came in, long before that, we were still paying quite a bit of attention to the Pacific area, and had a lot of squadrons out here. So,
did shortages ever develop in technical officers with technical training, such as armaments, wire communications, meteorological people? Did it ever show up as a problem during the war?
It didn't really. Surprising enough, we were able to set up the training establishments and schools to produce those specialists just as rapidly as we were to set up the schools to produce the air crew and the ground crew. I suppose it would be wrong to say that we didn't have some shortages. In 1939-40 period, I guess that was the... I'm more familiar with the armament side than I am with the others, although I think the same thing applied to signals. The expansion was great enough in new command headquarters and new stations and so on, that we were hard-pressed to meet the demand for armored officers in that first year, but we soon overcame that. And we had the armored school set up in fairly short order, the expanded armored school. The one that you and I talked about had been at Camp Borden, and then there was an expanded one in Trenton, and it produced at an accelerated rate until such time as a new armored school was created at Mountain View. Mountain View became, which wasn't very far from Trenton, it was in Prince Edward County, not Prince Edward Island, Prince Edward County, just adjacent to the Bay of Quinte. And it became a large armament school and a bombing gunnery school. It was a pretty big unit. And it was able to produce all sorts of armorers, and I think by that time we had ceased to call them armament artificers. But they became armorers. And the demand for armorers was pretty heavy, as you might expect. And the demand for armament officers was quite heavy.
Who were the people that became those? Air crew? People that... You literally joined to become air crew.
Yeah.
That's the way you went into the Air Force.
Yeah.
Now, did people actually join to become ground officers in the ground?
Oh, yes.
Or were they people
didn't
they washed out of flying school who were...
Well, yeah.
In
some cases, that would apply.
Yeah.
But in other cases, there would be people, chaps who wanted to serve in the Air Force, but found that perhaps they wanted to be air crew. But found that they physically were not able to meet the standards. Eyes or ears or some other physical ailment might have prevented that. Then, of course, there were other chaps with some technical bent who were a little bit too old to become air crew. And the requirements were pretty stringent at that time, age requirements. And... you could be too old while you're still in your 20s in those days.
Yeah.
I've forgotten what it was, 28 or something like that. And maybe it was even... I don't think it was when I was 25 at that stage, but it was around 28 probably. And it was that type of fellow that became an armored officer. And then, of course, we commissioned a number from the ranks. We had some... outstanding chaps who were fitters and who were armorers, and even held the grand trade description of armored artificer, who were commissioned and made into armored officers. So, and that same sort of thing applied to the Signal Corps. We had, to the Signals branch. We had quite a number of members of the Royal Canadian Corps of Signals in the several years just before the war, transfer to Signals in the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them had been operating fairly intimately with aviation on those stations up in the Northwest Territories, the primary purpose of which was providing communications with aircraft traveling in the north. And they looked after facilities not only for the RCF pilots up there, but for commercial operators and so on. For quite a time, they were the communication system in the North Country. Well, after some years of operation on the closely associated with aviation, when we made a request for an assistance from the Signal Corps to expand our communications branch, it was agreed that there could be an appeal for volunteers, and quite a number of those fellows volunteered, and there's some excellent chaps came from that source. Well, in the early years of the war, there were a fair number of them were commissioned and acted as signal officers, and there were, some of them went on to fairly senior rank and very first-class fellows. So that's the way, and of course the navigators were trained under the training plan. Engineer officers, well, University of Toronto, I think, came in and stepped right in there, and very quickly we got training courses underway, and I suppose it applied to certain other universities too, and And the engineer and technical fellow was trained there until such time as we got our own facilities established. And
did they run accelerated courses at the university for, sorry, aero engineers, for example? And
Well, special courses. Yeah, they weren't
not degree courses.
No, aeronautical engineering was too long a course, and so these were special courses. So that's the way it was. It was handled.
That was the medical too. Yeah. So that's great expansion in the medical department of the Air Force as well.
Yeah. I think maybe that's enough on the subject of Canadian reaction to the formation of squadrons overseas. I want to come back to this later. I won't try to do it today. I want to talk about Canadianization as such on a subsequent tape, because notwithstanding the undertaking that was made to form these so-called Canadian squadrons, it was to develop later that Canada was very dissatisfied with the rate of progress and the extent to which Canadianization was taking place in the so-called Canadian squadrons. I'll just say that in the operational training units in the UK where crews were formed, you see, we were sending pilots over and navigators over and air gunners over and wireless operators over and so on. And they all had to be brought together at some place. Well, these people flowed into what was called operational training units, where the pilots got onto the type of operational aircraft that they were going to fly. They started off with something that was a little bit less demanding, perhaps, than the actual aircraft they were going to fly, and they got experience on it, and then they moved to a second stage where they got on to training. If it was a Halifax they were going to fly in operations, before they left that school, they got a fair amount of experience on the Halifaxes. In the course of all this, they got crewed up. And the chief instructor and I suppose the certain other members of the staff of these schools had the responsibility of putting these crews together. To a certain extent, there was a personal preference that influenced it. Some pals might get together and decide, well, I'd like to have him as my pilot, or a pilot might say, I'd like to have him as my navigator and air gunner, and that would have some influence on it. But by and large, these fellows arrived there, didn't know enough.